They threatened to introduce a criminal ban on health care for trans young people. They passed a criminal ban on a 10-week abortion ban. So they're following the exact same playbook across the country, and they're working together. So I think it's important that we remind ourselves that we have to work together, too, because all of these fights are about whether or not we're ultimately going to be able to retain control over our body and our self-determination, and that is going to impact every aspect of our lives, you know, our ability to control our futures in the labor market, our education, our opportunities, our family planning. And these are critical, you know, LGBT issues, gender justice issues, and racial and economic justice issues as well.
Chase Strangio, Deputy Director for Transgender Justice with the ACLU's LGBT and HIV Project. Yancey Ford as well, first openly transgender director nominated for an Oscar Award for his film Strong Island in 2018. And that does it for our show. We'll be live streaming the Senate impeachment trial starting at 1 p.m. Eastern time today, as we do every day during the impeachment trial. On Thursday, we'll be joined by the actor, the director, the writer, Viggo Mortensen, about his new film called Falling. And Thursday's performance here in Salt Lake City, rather in Park City, at the Egyptian Theater of Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. The late, great historian Howard Zinn died 10 years ago this week. I'll also be speaking 2 o'clock on Friday here in Park City at the Park City Museum right next to Dolly's Bookstore. You can check it out at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkey, Nagesda Nermin Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Laura Gadisdina, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina and Dorote Marie Astudio. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman from Park City, Utah. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's 5:01. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up is the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is working with Beautiful Portland to collect socks and blankets for those who are sleeping outside this winter. There is a collection box in the lobby of KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, between Burnside and Ankeny. Donations are accepted Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Evening news. Coming up, lead found in water in Portland's public schools.
A look into the Remain in Mexico policy on its 1-year anniversary.
And in international news, climate change found to be a contributing factor in the increase of violence against women.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 29th, 2020. I'm Nat Moon.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has awarded Oregon $1.1 million to help the state identify sources of lead in drinking water at schools and childcare facilities. The Oregon Department of Education will use the money to provide funding, training, and technical assistance to schools and childcare facilities. Under state laws enacted in 2017, all public schools and licensed childcare facilities are required to test for lead in all water used for drinking or food preparation. Oregonians became aware that there might be lead in school water fountains and kitchen sinks after it was revealed that Portland Public Schools covered up lead testing results that showed elevated and even sky-high rates in the water. EPA Region 10 Administrator Chris Hladek said in a statement on Wednesday, quote, "Ensuring access to clean drinking water and protecting children from exposure to lead are critically important to the EPA. This funding will support our state's efforts to keep children in schools and childcare programs safe from the adverse health impacts of lead in drinking water."
An additional four former students at Catlin Gable School have filed a civil suit claiming they were sexually abused by their teachers. The new plaintiffs are seeking $9 million in damages from the exclusive private school, $2.25 million each for the psychological injuries, along with pain, suffering, and emotional distress. They also accuse the school itself of negligence in failing for years to adequately investigate claims of abuse and in not reporting its concerns to the police. One of the lawyers representing the former students, Peter Jancy, argues that the school spent much of the past 40 years looking the other way as a handful of teachers preyed on their students. This lawsuit is the first to go beyond Catlin Gable's own internal report by accusing a teacher who had not been identified by name before. The lawsuit names Roy Stubbs, who worked for the school from 1980 to 1982. Catlin officials have said the current administration has cooperated fully with law enforcement and remains committed to finding the truth and helping the victims.
While heroism is usually a spontaneous action, it can lead to future rewards. Today, Westland High School named Keanan Lowe, Park Rose coach and one of Time magazine's Heroes of 2019, as its new football coach. Last May, the former University of Oregon standout took a shotgun away from a student who was later determined to be suicidal. A viral video surfaced afterwards showing Lowe hugging the student in the hallway after taking the gun away. In 2019, Lowe had led Park Rose to its first state playoff win in program history and the Broncos' most successful season ever. In 2017, the year before Lowe became coach, Park Rose's record was 0-9. At West Lynn, Lowe replaces another Duck, Chris Miller, who left to coach in the XFL. Under Miller, West Lynn won the Class 6A state championship in 2016.
A new piece of legislation is looking to real estate transfer taxes as a way to raise money for affordable housing programs. Real estate transfer taxes are assessed when property changes ownership, and the new bill filed by Governor Kate Brown would exempt the first $500,000 of a property's value from taxation. Property values in Oregon are higher than ever, contributing to the state's homelessness crisis. But a 2012 measure that banned real estate transfer taxes from being part of Oregon's state constitution might stand in the bill's way. Measure 79, passed by voters in 2012, decided the state should not impose taxes when real estate changes hands. Brown filed the new resolution for the short legislative session set to begin next week.
Nearly 8,000 nurses and staff members of Seattle's Swedish health system are in the second day of a three-day strike today. Swedish closed two of its seven emergency rooms and has said it will spend millions on replacement workers. The labor action, called by SEIU Local 1199NW, which represents 7,800 workers at Swedish, is one of the largest hospital strikes in the U.S. in recent years and comes during both a national shortage of nurses and increasing hospital consolidation. Management has proposed raises totaling 11.25% over 4 years, less than half of what the union is seeking. Swedish is a nonprofit organization, but since it was taken over by a much larger nonprofit health system in 2012, Workers claim administrators have been cutting costs at the expense of patients. Swedish has an 11% vacancy rate, a staffing shortage that the system meets by hiring temporary and traveling staff. Healthcare unemployment in the Seattle area is less than 1%.
Climate change is contributing to the increase in violence against women and girls around the world. A study by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature found, quote, gender-based violence to be pervasive, and there is enough clear evidence to suggest that climate change is increasing gender-based violence. Gender-based violence includes domestic violence, sexual assault and rape, forced prostitution, forced marriage and child marriage, and other forms of exploitation of women. Incidences of human trafficking are on the rise in areas where the environment is experiencing climate change, and a correlation was found between the increase in gender-based violence and environmental crimes like wildlife poaching and illegal resource extraction. Weather-related disasters have been shown to increase sexual trafficking by up to 30%. In most parts of the world, women are already disadvantaged and lack land rights and legal rights, leading to their continuing vulnerability and exploitation. With the additional stress of climate crises, women are the first to be targeted. Yet according to the report, few organizations and projects display any recognition of these issues. At the UN Climate Conference in Madrid last December, governments were criticized for ignoring the plight of women and children. Said Kate Oren, a lead author of the report, quote, gender-based violence is one of the most pervasive but least talked about barriers that face us in conservation and climate work. We need to take the blinders off and pay attention.
A new study has found that the financial and economic impact of being denied an abortion causes a large and persistent increase in financial distress for up to 6 years after the intended abortion. The economic fallout of being forced to carry a baby to term lasts for years when compared with pregnant individuals who were able to get an abortion. The study found that pregnant people suffer financially not only because they've had a child, but because they were forced to do so at a time when they weren't prepared or didn't want to have a child. The study was revolutionary in that it followed approximately 1,000 women since 2008 and asked the question, if you wanted to get an abortion and weren't allowed to, would you be better off? People with vulvas who have been turned away from getting abortions have been found to have worse mental health and poorer physical health in the long term. In recent years, a growing number of states have tried to limit access to abortions or restrict them altogether. Since 2011, states have enacted 483 new abortion restrictions, including mandated waiting periods, required parental consent, and limits on public funding. One in four women has an abortion during their lifetime.
Native groups are celebrating a new affordable housing development in Portland that will give tribes housing preference. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A federal appeals court panel told a Wisconsin tribe it cannot review a decision by two agencies that reinforce Michigan's permitting authority over a proposed mine on the Michigan-Wisconsin border. Danielle Kading reports.
The Menominee Tribe says plans for an Aquila Resources mine near the Menominee River in Michigan's Upper Peninsula don't do enough to protect water quality and cultural sites. In an effort to address their concerns, tribal officials asked the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and Army Corps of Engineers whether federal review of a permit was necessary. The tribe filed the lawsuit when they said Michigan had sole permitting authority. Chairman Douglas Cox says the ruling is a huge disappointment.
There's government-to-government relations and a just responsibility that the government and those agencies owe the tribe, and they've failed.
Unlike federal agencies, Michigan is not required to consult with the tribe. Cox says they're contesting the mine's wetlands permit with the state. The U.S. Department of Justice did not immediately respond to a request for comment. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
A lengthy legal fight over an oil and gas lease on land sacred to Northwest Montana's Blackfeet Nation continued recently in federal court. The U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. heard arguments over the U.S. Interior Secretary's authority to cancel the lease. Aaron Bolton has more.
Former U.S. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell in 2016 canceled the last two remaining oil and gas leases in the Badger 2 Medicine area. Moncrief Oil and Solenex LLC took the Interior Department to court, arguing that the agency couldn't suddenly change its mind. Moncrief later settled out of court, but Solonex is still arguing its case. Tim Presso with Earth Justice is representing the Blackfeet Nation and environmental groups intervening in the case.
The challenged lease cancellation decision protects an area that the Blackfeet tribe has described as its last traditional sacred territory.
He backed the Interior Department's argument that the government had the right to cancel the oil and gas lease because it violated environmental and federal cultural protections. Solonex attorney David McDonald told justices that the Interior Secretary lacked authority to overturn the lease decades after it was approved.
Because whatever authority agencies may have to reconsider their decisions, that authority must be exercised within a reasonable period of time.
However, justices questioned McDonald about the Interior Department's reluctance to approve drilling on Solonex's lease because it was still determining if that activity would violate federal law. McDonald argued the decision to deny its drilling permit request doesn't void the underlying lease, and future technology may be able to mitigate environmental and cultural harms in the area. It's unclear when the appellate court may hand down its decision. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Flags on the Navajo Nation are being flown at half-staff Wednesday in honor of Sophie Yazzie. Yazzie was said to be the longest-living veteran in Arizona. She passed away Saturday at age 105. Yazzie was born in 1914 in Canyon de Chelly. At age 28, she joined the Army Air Corps and served during World War II. After her military service, she worked at a boarding school and raised a family. Funeral services are being held Wednesday in St. Michael's, Arizona, on the Navajo Nation. She will be buried at the Fort Defiance Veterans Memorial. The Confederated Tribes of Tsleil-Waututh Indians, Portland's Native American Youth and Family Center, and other Native organizations are celebrating the opening of an affordable housing development in Northeast Portland. A ribbon-cutting ceremony and tour is taking place Wednesday. The 59-unit building is intended to help address housing issues in the city. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Foreign governments evacuated their citizens from Wuhan on Wednesday as the World Health Organization voiced, quote, grave concern about person-to-person spread in other countries. More than 200 passengers returning to the United States were asked to stay at the March Air Reserve Base in Southern California to allow medical officers to perform more thorough screenings. The plane departed Wuhan on Tuesday and stopped in Anchorage, Alaska to refuel. Passengers were screened for coronavirus before takeoff, during the flight, during refueling, and after arriving. China remains on full and partial lockdowns across many major cities, affecting over 60 million people in the region. There have been over 6,000 cases in 15 countries and at least 162 deaths in China since coronavirus was first identified on December 8, 2019. The WHO's panel of 16 independent experts has so far refused to declare an international emergency, but plans to re-evaluate the situation on Thursday. Like other respiratory infections, the new virus is spread by droplets from cough and sneezes with an incubation time between 1 and 14 days.
On January 29, 2019, the United States government sent a Honduran asylum seeker back to Tijuana to wait for his immigration court date. That was the first person subjected to the Remain in Mexico policy, and since then, people from South America, Central America, and Mexico have been affected. The policy, officially called the Migrant Protection Protocols, sends asylum seekers, regardless of their country of origin, to the most dangerous cities in Mexico to wait for their court dates back in the United States. The policy has been called a, quote, daunting nightmare, end quote, and there are concerns that immigrants with valid claims are abandoning their cases because things are so bad in Mexico. The cities are reportedly so violent that the United States State Department recommends U.S. citizens avoid visiting them. On the one-year anniversary of the program, advocates and immigrants say the Trump administration's policy has put tens of thousands of asylum seekers in more danger than ever. Nearly 60,000 people have been put under the program since it began on the border separating Tijuana from San Diego. Human Rights First released a report last week that found more than 800 public reports of murder, torture, rape, kidnapping, and other violent attacks against asylum seekers and immigrants returned to Mexico under the program. Robin Barnard, An attorney at Human Rights First said on Wednesday, quote, despite not getting all the money he needed to build a wall, the president has effectively built a wall to keep asylum seekers out of this country.
Representing more than 500,000 students and 5.7 million living alumni, the Association of Big Ten Students unanimously passed a resolution calling on their schools to divest from the fossil fuel industry. The resolution asks the schools to freeze all future planned investments in fossil fuels and to develop a timeline for divestment from the industry as quickly as possible, beginning this year. The Big Ten is actually 14 colleges, including the University of Michigan, Ohio State, and Northwestern. The University of Michigan alone has over $1 billion invested in the fossil fuel industry. 4 months ago, the University of California system announced it was divesting from fossil fuel companies. Yesterday, students at the Oxford University in England held a sit-in demanding the school divest its $10 million in known fossil fuel investments, as well as any undisclosed investments.
The British newspaper The Guardian announced it will no longer accept advertising from oil and gas companies. The ban applies, quote, to any business primarily involved in extracting fossil fuels, including many of the world's largest polluters, end quote. The Guardian urged media outlets across the globe to follow their lead. Climate activist Greta Thunberg said of The Guardian's action, quote, a good start. Who will take this further, end quote. Guardian executives acknowledged that some readers would like the company to turn down advertising for any product with a significant carbon footprint, such as cars or air travel, but said this was not possible given the company's precarious financial condition. Mel Evans, senior climate campaigner for Greenpeace UK, said, quote, oil and gas firms now find themselves alongside tobacco companies as businesses that threaten the health and well-being of everyone on this planet.
The Pacific Ocean along the west coast of the United States has become so acidic that the exoskeletons of crab larvae are dissolving. According to a new study published earlier this month, man-made climate change is disrupting marine environments, and we are still discovering the full extent of its harmful effects. While we burn fossil fuels, oceans absorb a third of the emitted carbon dioxide. Underwater, some of that gas dissolves, effectively raising the acidity of the water. This low acidity bleaches coral reefs and makes oceans uninhabitable for all kinds of marine life. According to the study, the last time the oceans were acidifying as quickly as they are now, 96% of all marine life was driven to extinction.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for This Way Out, hosted by Lucia Chappelle. At 6, it's special public affairs programming. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is a 50% chance of showers before 10 p.m., clouds with patchy fog and a low of 42. Tomorrow's weather is an 80% chance of rain with a high of 53. Today in history, in 2014, one of the founders of France's weekly satirical publication, Charlie Hebdo, died. Charlie Hebdo was the target of a terrorist attack on Free Press in 2015 that killed 12 people. After the attack, the phrase Je suis Charlie, or in English, I am Charlie, was adopted by supporters of free speech around the world. The quote of the day is from Edgar Allan Poe, whose most famous poem, The Raven, was first published on this day in 1845. Quote, beauty of whatever kind in its supreme development invariably excites the sensitive soul to tears.
Today is day 9 of Donald Trump's trial in the U.S. Senate for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. The Senate held a question and answer session with both the House impeachment managers and Trump's legal team. Representative Zoe Lofgren challenged the Trump legal team claim that the House did not fulfill its duty in carrying out an investigation, pointing out that the executive branch completely refused to comply with the House impeachment inquiry and refused their subpoenas.
President Trump issued a blanket order directing the entire executive branch to withhold all documents and testimony from the House of Representatives. This order was categorical, it was indiscriminate, unprecedented. Its purpose was clear: to prevent Congress from doing its duty under the Constitution to hold the president accountable for high crimes and misdemeanors. Telling every person who works in the White House and every person who works in every department, agency, and office of the executive branch is just not precedented. It wasn't about specific, narrowly defined privileges. He never asserted privileges. And the president's counsel has mentioned over and over that he had some reason because of the subpoenas. Well, I'll tell you, we adopt rules about subpoenas in the House. The Senate is a continuing body, but the House isn't. And in January, we adopted our rules, and it allows the committee chairman to issue subpoenas. And that's what they did. He refused to comply with those subpoenas, not because he exerted executive privilege, because he didn't like what we were doing. He tried to say it was invalid, but it was valid, and actually, he doesn't have the authority to be the arbiter of the rules of the House. The House is the sole arbiter of its rules when it comes to impeachment. Now, this refusal to give testimony documents, like, it's still going on. We still have former or current administration officials who are refusing to testify. He wouldn't, you know, we would not allow this in any other context. You know, if a mayor said, I'm not going to answer your subpoenas, they'd be dealt with harshly if it was to cover up misdeeds and crimes as we have here. So mayors have actually gone to jail for doing that. If we allow the president to avoid accountability by simply refusing to provide any documents, any witnesses, unlike every single president who preceded him, we're opening the door not just to eliminating the impeachment clause in the Constitution. Try doing oversight. Try doing oversight, senators, and we're thinking about that in the House. If the president can just say, we're not sending any witnesses, we're not sending any documents, we don't have to, we don't like your processes, we have a wholesale rejection of what you're doing. That's not the way our Constitution was created, where each body has a responsibility. There's a sharing of power. I know you, cherish the responsibility that we have. That will be eviscerated if the president's complete stonewalling is allowed to persist and be accepted by this body. You have to act now in this moment of history. I yield back.
Representative Hakeem Jeffries answered a question about whether calling witnesses would extend the trial too long. Here's the Chief Justice asking the question of Jeffries.
Some have claimed that subpoenaing witnesses or documents would unnecessarily prolong this trial. Isn't it true that depositions of the three witnesses in the Clinton trial were completed in only one day each? And isn't it true that the Chief Justice, as presiding officer in this trial, has the authority to resolve any claims of privilege or other witness issues without any delay?
Mr. Chief Justice, the answer is yes. What is clear, based on the record that was compiled by the House of Representatives, where up to five depositions per week were completed, that this can be done in an expeditious fashion. It's important to note that the record that exists before you right now contains strong and uncontroverted evidence that President Trump pressured a foreign government to target an American citizen for political and personal gain as part of a scheme to cheat in the 2020 election and solicit foreign interference. That is evidence from witnesses who came forward from the Trump administration, including individuals like Ambassador Bill Taylor, West Point graduate, Vietnam War hero, including individuals like Ambassador Sondland, who gave $1 million to President Trump's inauguration. Respected national security professionals like Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, as well as Dr. Fiona Hill. 17 different witnesses, Trump administration employees, troubled by the corrupt conduct that took place as alleged and proven by the House of Representatives. But to the extent that there are ambiguities in your mind, this is a trial. A trial involves witnesses. A trial involves documents. A trial involves evidence. That is not a new phenomenon for this distinguished body. The Senate in its history has had 15 different impeachment trials. In every single trial, there were witnesses. Every single trial. Why should this president be treated differently, held to a lower standard at this moment of presidential accountability?
A member of Trump's legal team, law professor Alan Dershowitz, made the argument that a president can engage in quid pro quo behavior in order to aid his reelection chances because he thinks his reelection is in the public interest.
Every public official that I know believes that his election is in the public interest. And mostly you're right. Your election is in the public interest. And if a president does something which he believes will help him get elected in the public interest, that cannot be the kind of quid pro quo that results in impeachment.
Representative Adam Schiff called Dershowitz's argument odd because it would open the doors to all kinds of corruption. He later answered a question.